The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we will call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. So we will start out with the David's bill, and then we will... is there a protest going on here or something? What's going on? Must not be on TV or something. Okay. So what we will do, we have called the meeting to order, and we will... just pause a little bit and let some members arrive here. No, we won't recess. This is too much fun. Why don't we start out? Why don't we, if Mr. Stinson, Mr. Showalter, Ms. Kelly. Okay, Representative Wardle is here. We can start now. Do we have the crew here from, I mean, everybody's gone. MMB or the state economist here? Okay. I didn't get the memo. We have a fire.
Sasha, are your members coming?
Is it something I said?
What's going on?
Part of it's the K-12.
Oh, now we can start. Now we can start. We can start now. Mark Ward's here. So.
Oh, it's two. Three. You have three members. Four. Oh, yeah, you're two.
We were held late in our last class.
Sorry. This is going to sound really good.
10:15.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, we will recess to the call of the chair. Hopefully in about 5 minutes we can get going, but we will recess right now.
Here's what I did.
Hey, Roger.
Hey, Roger.
Oh, you have. And that's what it was. It was part of the road to initiate. And it was at the time when you needed something special.
Good to see you.
I didn't know.
You're gonna take a multi
I had to say
so just in case
Do you want the long version, the short version, or something in between? Yeah, so we'll just do the presentation and hold questions.
It's just that it was transparent and specific. So short. How can you tell that?
That was
crazy.
Thank you. She's just
going to
be late.
Oh, late?
Who's going to be late?
How are you? Good.
What do we got to get to? 7:15?
Hi there.
We had to move Barrett's bill.
Hey, how are you? I have a page question.
Okay, one
second.
Thank you very much.
My page question is,
so we're going to start about
person get one of those,
and then I'll just, when we get a corner, I'll interrupt the presentation.
I don't know. I could find out.
Why?
I could find out.
Yeah, I can write it out.
You don't have to find out now, but maybe after committee, we can go back
to ask,
where
yeah.
the pages come from.
Down there.
Yeah, ask somebody. Because I keep having to put my chair down at the bottom because my feet touch the ground. And then I feel really short relative to my
peers. Pie chart.
Oh, yeah.
A pipeline.
If I have one of those key things, then I can boost my chair.
Yeah, I'll ask.
Be like everybody else.
I'll ask.
Okay, thanks.
Maybe I can get lunch by 11:30.
I will call the meeting back to order. As soon as we have a quorum, we will take care of some housekeeping items here. When we have a quorum, I'll be moving. We're going to look at House File 701 and then lay it over for possible inclusion, the omnibus bill. So I will, since I can't move anything, I'll just start describing the bill. Then we're very fortunate today to have MMB Commissioner Showalter here with the state economist Tom Stinson, the new state budget director, Margaret Kelly, who we are rounding up to having been on the job for a week, I believe, will be joining us. And so House File 701 members, when we have a quorum, I'll be moving that and then laying it over for possible inclusion. What this does is this is a bill that we had last year with Representative Reinert, was the author, and now, of course, Senator Reinert, and he's carrying this bill. I'm carrying this bill as the House author. He is the Senate author this year. And what it does, it's an income reciprocity benchmark study, which basically looks at, we've had reciprocity with Wisconsin for many, many years. Governor Pawlenty canceled it last year, the year before, in there somewhere. And so what this bill does, this is not reinstating reciprocity. This is the bill that would say we're going to look at some benchmarks as to where we have been, where we are now, and then where we want to go. So basically, that's what this bill does. This is not reinstating reciprocity. This is collecting some data to figure out, how this should work. And I will have an amendment, the A1 amendment. This is basically last year's bill. What the amendment does, it updates the years from 2010 to 2011, and then 2012 to 2013 on lines 16 and 18. So with that, let's get our presenters today set up to present the budget forecast and so forth, and then we will start with them, and I will rudely interrupt them as soon as we have a quorum to conduct a few pieces of business from the minutes to the House File 701. And while they're getting set up, are there any questions from members on House File 701, the reciprocity study with Wisconsin? Or members, we'll be looking at questions that you may have on the timeline to see what members of the committee are thinking about that. Any questions or concerns on the timeline that we've laid out? Representative Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, I know your study is with Wisconsin, which, of course, we had reciprocity with, but is there any interest in looking at other border issues? I'll use my daughter going back to 1994 as an example. She got her master's degree at the University of North Dakota and then started to substitute teach, and she taught in Grand Forks, East Grand Forks, and the following year signed a contract to teach in Northern Kentucky, three tax returns in that single year. And I know we can't solve as far away as Kentucky, but I wonder if there aren't some things that could be done to simplify between Iowa and the Dakotas. I know this bill is focused on the history of reciprocity with Wisconsin, and that's the biggest one with the Twin Cities, and probably Duluth being that he was very interested in it being large border communities, but there is Moorhead and East Grand Forks and so on.
Speaking
to the Minnesota taxpayer that has to fill out all those additional forms.
Yes, Representative Carlson, we currently, and staff can correct me if I'm wrong, or research can, we currently have reciprocity with North Dakota, and we have it with Michigan. I couldn't figure out why Michigan, but the UP comes over quite a ways, yeah. And so there's actually some folks there. This one is Wisconsin. Of course, it begs the question, should we be talking about this with South Dakota and Iowa? My interest in this House File 701 is Houston County is the county in Minnesota that's affected negatively in the largest numbers of any county, because in where I live, the regional center is on the other side of the border, whereas with Hudson and so forth, you know, they're coming over to Minneapolis-St. Paul in the suburbs, and then you've got Superior coming to Duluth. We're having Houston County goes to Wisconsin. It's a big problem. And you pointed out, I mean, just the number of tax returns. So this one's simply Wisconsin, but I'd certainly be opening to looking at Iowa, South Dakota,
Mr. Chairman,
probably not Kentucky.
The had reciprocity with North Dakota. I don't know how far that goes back, but...
Mr. Michael or Ms. Manzi?
I didn't remember it as an issue in 94, but then...
How far back do we go? The question is, how far back do we go with the reciprocity with North Dakota?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I'm not sure exactly how far back it goes, but it's been in place for quite a long time. I think to the 80s, but I'm not absolutely positive.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, the reciprocity agreements with North Dakota and with Michigan, unlike the one that we had with Wisconsin, do not provide for any payments from one state to another, because the number of taxpayers affected is considered to be relatively small, and they're considered to be relatively similar numbers who live in one state and work in the other state. The agreement with Wisconsin was a little bit different, since there are generally agreed that there are more taxpayers who live in Wisconsin and work in Minnesota than the other way around, so it included provisions for payments from Wisconsin to Minnesota to compensate for the revenue loss, and that's part of what led to its being terminated by the governor last year.
Would you still have to fill
out... Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Manzi, would you still have to fill out two tax forms then?
Just Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, no. If you lived in Minnesota and worked in North Dakota, you would only have to fill out a Minnesota return, and conversely, if you lived in North Dakota and worked in Minnesota, you would only have to fill out a North Dakota return.
Maybe my memory
is
a little foggy going back to 1994, but I thought there were two forms, but I might be wrong on that then.
Okay.
Now, thank you.
And also, on the South Dakota issue, they don't have a state income tax, so that... don't need to look at South Dakota, but I'd certainly be open to Iowa. Of course, I border Iowa and Wisconsin. So we'll come back to this bill as soon as we have a quorum or one member short. So what we'll do is we'll start out with Commissioner Showalter, the state economist Tom Stinson, and the new state budget director Margaret Kelly. Oh, we have a quorum. So I was going to have to interrupt you. Now I won't have to do that. First of all, Representative Mack moves the minutes of... I'll officially call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Mack moves the minutes of March 1st. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And again, members that are here, please look at the timeline. And if we have questions about that, we can get together after. I don't think we'll be using all the time. we have such an interesting presentation coming that we may have a lot of questions, and so we might go right up till noon. But if we don't, and you've got questions on the timeline, please just let me know. So I will move House File 701. We don't have to move that, do we? Well, I moved the House File 701 before the committee. I would, to get the bill in the order I would like, I will move the A1 amendment. Any questions on the A1 amendment? We're just updating the bill basically from last year to this year. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. I now have 701 in the order I would like it. Questions to Representative Lencheski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a thought on the income tax reciprocity, and I understand what the area you represent, why you would definitely want to do this, but I did support Governor Pawlenty's hard stand against Wisconsin, and they still owe us money, and you're the chair, so you get to decide what goes in the omnibus tax bill, but have you considered language that would say this doesn't happen until Wisconsin gives us the money, that the enactment date is after payment?
Well, we can certainly look at that and talk about that further. I did find the other day I was listening to Greta Van Susteren, and Governor Walker was on there, and he said, you know, we need to get all this stuff settled because we owe Minnesota $58 million, I think he said, or 69 or something like that, whatever the number is. He's making it a bit more difficult for me right now. I believe that when they get their budget passed, that I believe that those numbers are included in their budget, and they should be able to get the check to us quite quickly. So, but we'll certainly talk about that. This is just, I wanted to get a hearing out on this today so members can take a look at this. And again, this is the study. This is not the tax reciprocity reinstatement. So it's at this point, it's the study. I will be bringing forward a bill to reinstate tax reciprocity, and so we'll have those discussions. But is there anyone in the audience that would wish to testify for or against House File 701 as amended? Dr. Wilson, could you join us for a short time here to maybe just give a little bit of history here and where we're at? And again, members, this is the study. This is the companion to the Reinert bill over in the Senate. Of course, his interests are similar to mine in that we're fortunate to represent border communities. Please state your name for the record and who you represent, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Wilson from the Research Division at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Just want to make a few comments. You do not have a fiscal note for this bill at this time. Part of it is that the methodology we would use changes quite a bit with the amendment. But if I can say a few words about the study. I realize this is only a study. Do you want any background on on the cancellation?
Well, if you could briefly, maybe just okay. Even a little further back than that, kind of when it started, how long we've had it, and then the cancellation.
Mr. Chair, I'm not, let me see.
And that's okay.
I don't think I have history, but it goes back, I think, to 1973. The first study was done in 1976 to set a benchmark for payment because Wisconsin has more people working here than we have working there. The benchmark was updated, I believe, twice since then. So this would be then the fourth benchmark study is what we'd be talking about. The reason for reciprocity, of course, is to simplify tax filing. I mean, it is to keep people from having to file two returns. And there are, you know, 13,000 Minnesotans will have to pay tax to Wisconsin this year who wouldn't have to do that process if we had reciprocity in 2010. That's out of about 20,000 or so who work in Wisconsin, but some of them wouldn't owe tax. So the reason is simplicity, but the cost under the old agreement was fairly high. And, of course, the reason that Governor Pawlenty canceled the agreement basically was the delay, the 17-month delay in our getting the money. Now, that's one of three issues with reciprocity. That one's easily fixed. We make estimated payments on income tax. Wisconsin can make estimated payments on a quarterly, semi-annually, or even monthly basis, get us the money on time. There's no real reason that an agreement has to have a delay. So that problem is fairly, I mean, that can be negotiated and can be solved. The second problem that with the agreement was that we believe that given the outdated benchmark, we were receiving about $12 million a year, $12 to $14 million a year less than what would have been full compensation based just upon the benchmark. This was not Wisconsin doing something wrong. This was the agreement. It did not take into account the increasing percentage of people in the border counties who were working in Minnesota. And so we are being undercompensated. That, again, the benchmark study, Mr. Chair, would, in fact, solve that, although we have to figure a better way to update the benchmark to grow it into future years to take those kind of things into account. But that can be solved. And then the third problem, potentially, with reciprocity is that when you have reciprocity between Minnesota and Wisconsin, the two states actually lose money. There's a net loss, we estimate, about $3 million between the two states. And the reason for that is if I work in Wisconsin, under reciprocity, I pay Minnesota taxes. Under reciprocity, I pay Minnesota taxes. Without it, I pay the higher of Wisconsin or Minnesota taxes. And since everybody pays, with reciprocity, pays their home state, but without it, they pay the higher of the two, reciprocity means some people pay less tax and nobody pays more. And so there's a net loss to the states combined. That net loss is small if the two states have about the same level of taxation. But $3 million is still a pretty big number. If we have 20,000 people affected who are Minnesota residents, that's well over $100 per person per year we're paying for simplifying tax filing in this case. And that's not one that's easy. The old agreement made us take the hit on that. Minnesota paid that $3 million. We didn't get reimbursed for that $3 million. So there's sort of three issues involved. In terms of the benchmark study itself, I would say it's essential. Mr. Chair, you're right. If you're going to bring back reciprocity, this is essential. We have to get a new benchmark study. There just is no question. We can't bring it back under the old benchmark, and we can't renegotiate a benchmark. It has to be done as a study. Wisconsin would have to do a study at the same time that we're doing it to make it work. However, if you don't bring reciprocity back, the study is not useful for any other purpose. Okay. This study is not something that will give you information that will help you decide whether to bring reciprocity back. This study simply determines how much money we'd have to have in terms of the give and take between the two states, but it's not really going to help you make that decision. And it's a lot of resources to use to get information. So, I mean, I guess the Department of Revenue's feeling is that the decision about reciprocity being reinstated ought to come before a decision on a study, because the study really is not for the purpose of informing you better about what to do with it. Just a couple comments on the cost itself. We were pleased that you changed the bill to use 2011, because we have time to put a question on the tax return for 2011 that says, do you have income in Wisconsin? We did not put that question on last year on the 2010 returns, so using 2010 we would have had a lot of searching to find people. The other issue with the fiscal note is that these forms that we have to look at, the form M1NR for non-residents and the form M1CR for credits paid to another state, these forms are not scanned, so we do not have digital data from these forms. So to do this study, we have to actually look at each form individually. There's a lot of data entry process. We'd like to look at the option of trying to get that digital information for 2011. And that may be cheaper than actually doing all the data entry that we'd have to do otherwise. So the fiscal note will take a while we try to sort out sort of the best way to do the study. The study is not a redo of other studies. We've never done a study in a year we didn't have reciprocity. We've always done them in years we have had reciprocity. And the whole approach to this is completely different in those 2 years. It's actually easier, I think, to do it without reciprocity than with it. If reciprocity were reinstated, the methodology would have to change. If it were reinstated for 2011, we'd have to use completely different methodology to do this study. Couple other just quick comments. One is, it would be a lot easier to do the study and to administer reciprocity if only wage earners were covered. Our old agreement included self-employed people, and I know there's some advantage to doing that. But most states with reciprocity, in fact, I'm not aware of any other state with reciprocity that includes self-employed people. It's normally limited to wage earners. We can track wage earners much easier. So in terms of doing the study, one decision that would really help us is to know for sure whether self-employed people are actually included in whatever agreement's being talked about doing the study. The other thing is that this will take cooperation from Wisconsin. The timeline is a little tight given that the returns don't come in from extension returns don't come in until mid-October. we have to get cooperation with Wisconsin, and we found in the past that whenever we have time to work on this, they don't, and whenever they have time to work on it, we don't, when we've done these studies before. So coordination across the border could become a little bit of a problem. One other just detail in terms of drafting, we don't think we have, without an agreement, we don't think we have the right to share information with Wisconsin about taxpayers. So in drafting, we think that something, we're not absolutely certain about that, but we think it'd be better to put some language in that would say we can share the information as part of this if it were to go forward. Anyway, if there are further questions, I can answer them, but that's basically our take and why there is not a fiscal note at this time.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson. Any questions for Dr. Wilson? Okay, thank you very much. With that, the chair lays over House File 701 as amended for possible include. Oh, I'm sorry, back off. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is not necessarily for Dr. Wilson, but it's for the committee as a whole. Is there some document that the history and the background of this issue? I'm thinking there may be something already available. And again, this is more history and background.
Very, very good question. Dr. Wilson? We missed you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I apologize because I had that document with me when I left the department, but I don't have it. But there is a nice summary that was prepared for a meeting, I think last summer or two summers ago, and I'll get that to the chair.
Dr. Wilson, if you could, get that to the chair, and we'll get it to every member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson.
Okay, thank you very much. With that, I will lay over House File 701 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. If you could please join us, Dr. Stinson, Commissioner Showalter, and the new State Budget Director, Margaret Kelly. If you could please, each of you, first introduce yourselves for the record and who you represent, and then we will get into your presentation. And members, if we could listen to the presentation and then hold questions, just write them down, and we'll have questions after the presentation. That usually works a little better. So if you just write your questions down. Please, as I said, state your name for the record and who you represent.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Management and Budget.
Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director.
And I'm Tom Stinson. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota, and I also serve as the state economist.
Welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're pleased to bring this presentation to you today. This is something that everyone has, I'm sure, seen the number by now, but hopefully we can give you a little bit more depth of understanding of the economic assumptions that are in here, some of the questions, and some of the financial parameters that the state will need to manage in the coming weeks. The slides that you see on the overhead, I believe, are in everyone's folders. That's what we'll be working off of. In addition to that, there's a brief narrative summary along with another level of information. This is still a summary of the real forecast, which is a much more expanded document, which is hopefully available on our website right now. And it's about 100 pages of very useful information that I would also commend to you as you want to find out more about some of the topics that we're about to discuss. In short, I'm pleased that the news here is good for the state, that the economy is making some improvements and that the revenue picture has improved somewhat with $1.2 billion in change in this forecast. However, we still have a $5 billion deficit, $5 billion gap between anticipated resources and expenditures based upon a current law forecast. This is really based, again, on the forecast process looks at authorizations for some of our major programs. Change makes adjustments based upon population or economic assumptions. It makes those same updates based upon our tax laws and basically straight lines or puts into other spending areas what was enacted last biennium in the last legislation or else what riders would specify as to be the starting point. Most of the story that you see here is on the revenue side. There's a small change in expenditures, but really much of the discussion and the points that we're going to be raising here today relate to impacts of revenues. This second slide gives you a quick summary of the revenues and spending numbers that form the $5 billion projected deficit that we now forecast. What you see here is about a $447 million beginning balance. That's including the initial reserves in the cash flow account. That is going to grow to about $663 million in this forecast. Much of the improvement is really related to congressional actions that Dr. Stinson will talk about. Congressional actions that essentially provide another stimulus package that will impact both workers' paychecks as well as impact a very volatile source of revenues for us, the capital gains tax. Those changes improve the base and continue out into 12 and 13 to some extent, so that in the end we are seeing some revenue growth in 12 and 13. The deficit ultimately closes to about $5 billion. I should note that one provision that the tax committee would be very familiar with, which is one that takes any biennium ending balances and applies them to replenishing reserves, a situation certainly we need at this point, that is temporarily suspended due to the stimulus package and prohibitions on Congress on uses of some of the stimulus funds. So as a result, the 663 that you see on the bottom of this chart does not go into reserve. It is in fact rolls into 12 and 13 and is applied against the deficit that results in the $5 billion gap. That's the quick version here. We certainly have a number of challenges to deal with, but let's just talk about the economy and some of the revenue assumptions that are in this.
Okay, thank you. Before we go to Dr. Stinson, we are fortunate today to have the ninth grade student from St. Louis Park High School right over here. We welcome you to the Tax Committee. Oh, the ninth grade. That was my three favorite years of high school. Okay, welcome to the committee. Sir, if you could please once again state your name for the record and please give us your presentation, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Tom Stinson. I'm the state economist. As the commissioner indicated, revenues over the last are up a combined $984 million over November's forecast. That's $97 million, or about 0.6% for fiscal 11, and $887 million, or 2.7% for fiscal 12 and 13. Those aren't huge percentage changes, but they're certainly welcome, especially since the percentage changes are up rather than down like we've had in some of the last forecasts. The economic outlook improved, but most of the improvement in the economic outlook actually came as a result of changes in federal legislation that were lumped together as part of what's called the federal tax compromise or the December tax compromise. All the attention was focused on the extension of the Bush tax cuts, but those lower tax rates had actually been factored into most forecasts before they occurred. The things that weren't factored into most forecasts and that made a difference in the outlook for the economy, not just for Global Insight, but for almost all forecasters, were three changes. The first change was the reduction in the payroll tax, the 2%, 2 percentage point reduction in the payroll tax that's occurred. You've probably noticed that in your own paychecks. That's reduced the tax take on your salary and increased after-tax income. That by itself provided about $111 billion of additional money for consumers to spend over this year. Payroll tax reduction expires at the end of 2011, so it's a one-year piece of stealth stimulus, basically, that was put into place. There were two other items that were also put into place at that time. One was the 99-week extended unemployment insurance benefits were extended through the entire year of 2011. Most forecasters had those stopping at mid-year, and so that added some growth to the economy. And then there was also the expensing of capital equipment that's allowed through 2011 and then 50% in 2012. Combined, those three items allowed forecasters to increase their forecast, other things equal, by between 0.7% and 1%. Global Insight's November forecast was 2.3% growth, which is admittedly subpar economic growth. After the December tax compromise, they raised the forecast to 3.2% for 2011. As you can see on the chart on the screens right now, most of that additional growth or most of that stimulus is front-loaded into the first half of 2011. And you can see that by 2012 and 2013, there's really not much in the way of change in there. What's happened is that in budget terms, we have raised the base which growth was going to go on from in the future, and then the growth rate has stayed the same. Global Insight's projected growth rate for 2012 is 2.9%, the same growth rate as was expected in November. Well, that's the good news on the economy. The less good news on the economy is that even though we have stronger growth, it didn't change the outlook for employment very much. Global Insight still expects that jobs will not return to their 2007 levels until 2013, and in mid-2013 unemployment will still be about 7.8%. Our Minnesota forecast follows the same recovery path, although we're a little bit more optimistic with respect to the unemployment rate. Our unemployment rate forecast for the middle of 2013 is 6.8%. One of the things that you can do to follow this forecast to see if this forecast is on track comes on Friday. On Friday, there will be new payroll employment numbers issued for the month of February. In order for this forecast to come true, we have to average more than 200,000 jobs per month nationally over the next 2.5 years in order for this forecast to come true. So the number to pay attention to, don't pay attention, or you can pay attention to it, but don't focus on the unemployment rate. The number to pay attention to is the jobs growth number, and a number in excess of 200,000 would certainly be welcome, especially given that private employment only increased by 50,000 in January. Pay attention to the revisions to the January number as well. There could be some significant revisions to that number, but again, for this forecast to remain on track, we have to average more than 200,000 jobs a month. So that's the number to pay attention to when you're tracking the economy. There was one other change that wasn't anticipated in the December tax compromise, and it's a change that's of considerable interest and considerable importance to Minnesota's financial situation. If we go to the next slide, you can see that what happened was that the extension of the special 15% tax rate on capital gains, not allowing it to revert to its former level of 20%, provided a considerable amount of income. Capital gains for Minnesota is about 3% of our tax base of the adjusted gross income for Minnesota residents, and yet 65% of the revenue gain came from that extension of the lower rate. Why did it come from that? Why did this occur? Well, we do a current law forecast, and so we can't anticipate changes in federal law or changes in state law. The higher rate that was in place when we did the February forecast would have slowed down the turnover of portfolios, and people would have turned over their portfolios more slowly, that in turn would have produced less gain, less taxable gains, and we would have seen less revenue. By keeping the lower federal capital gains rate, we benefited from the increased turnover that was produced. It's a nice thing for Minnesota to get more money from a federal tax change, but in the broad stream of things, it's a slender reed to rely on. Capital gains are very volatile, as you and the rest of the members of the committees know that. And if you look at the next graph on here, you can see how volatile capital gains are. Unlike wages, which amount to about 75% of Minnesota's tax base, and which almost never go down in total, but just don't grow as quite as fast as they did or grow faster, capital gains can both increase very dramatically and decrease very dramatically. Now, the numbers on the graph that's before you on the screen are U.S. total realizations, net realizations, but the pattern is very similar to what we see in Minnesota. For Minnesota, the numbers are that in 2007, which is the peak year for capital gains realizations on this graph, resident realizations were about $10.9 billion. Over the next 2 years, we had roughly 50% declines in both of those 2 years, so that 2009, the most recent year that we have data for from the income tax sample, had only about $2.5 billion in tax in capital gains realizations. You can see the combination of the gold bars and the maroon bars show what the new forecast is. The gold bars are the amount that was added in this forecast. The reason for the significant amount of addition in 2011 was again because of this change in federal tax rates. There was some change in the estimate for the stock market growth in 2011, but the major force changing it was the federal tax rate change. Moving on to the revenue picture specifically, the forecast changed by $499 million, or about 3.2% for the income tax. Again, 65% of that was capital gains related, 35% was all other income growth. The sales tax up $250 million, about 2.8%. About two-thirds of that was an increase in actual sales tax receipts by the state. The other one-third of that is a decline in the outlook for sales tax refunds. The other item of note is down at the bottom. The other revenues up $108 million. That's a little deceptive in that $59 million of it reflects the transfer of the reciprocity receipts from Wisconsin from tax year 11 to tax year 12. And so that really doesn't reflect a change in there, just a change in the timing of those receipts. Another way of looking at it is the next slide. And here you can see the relative contributions of different parts of the tax base and different parts of taxes. Capital gains contributed 39% of the $887 million, about $348 million. Other income tax receipts, 17%. The sales tax, 19%. Sales tax refunds, lower sales tax refunds, 9%. And the combination of the corporate tax, the shift in reciprocity, and all other taxes, about 16%. what's happened in this forecast is that because of the capital gains issue, but then some other things that are going on as well, the confidence band around the forecast has widened. Now, in the past few years, the confidence band around the forecast has had a very small upside and a fairly substantial downside. But in this forecast, there is more upside potential as well as more downside potential. And so there still are significant uncertainties that need to be factored in as you make your decisions as to how you're going to deal with the budget problem. You put the list of uncertainties up here. You can see that we're not real certain about anything here, but there are some key issues that you need to be thinking about. One of them is geopolitical action or geopolitical events, and just reading the newspapers and looking at gasoline prices, everyone's aware of what's going on in the Middle East and the potential impact on the economy. Some quick rules of thumb are that a $10 a barrel increase in the price of oil adds about 25 cents to the price of gasoline, or price of a gallon of gas. In 1 year, that $10 a barrel oil price increase holds for a year, that causes about 0.5% decline in GDP compared to what it was. So a $10 a barrel increase in oil prices held for a year, other things equal, would reduce the forecast from 3.2% growth to 2.7% growth. And then if it was $20 a barrel, we'd reduce it from 3.2% to 2.2%, and so on. That means, translated into jobs, that it's about 250,000 jobs that would be lost from a $10 a barrel increase. So you can see that with $140 a barrel oil or $150 a barrel oil, this would cause some pretty significant changes to the economic outlook. Another way of looking at it is 1 penny per gallon increase in gasoline prices reduces discretionary consumer income by about $1 billion in a year. Now, if you remember the stealth stimulus that went on because of the payroll tax was the equivalent of $111 billion. So about a dollar increase in gasoline taxes would pretty well, or gasoline prices would pretty well use up all of the insurance that was provided for the economic growth by the stimulus package. There is the possibility, going on down the list a little bit, that employment growth will be stronger than we have forecast and has been forecast. That would not be an impossibility. Really, all the pieces are in place for stronger economic growth and stronger employment growth than has been reflected in this forecast. The problem is that nobody knows quite what's going to set it off. And if something sets off employment growth, we could see stronger employment growth than we've seen. That would be good news. There's a whole set of issues regarding commodity prices. The price of oil, of course, is an important factor in the forecast, but prices for other goods as well are a concern. That may affect consumer spending decisions.
Okay, Dr. Stinson, hold that thought there. Excuse me a second. We have the rest of the visitors from St. Louis Park, and we always talk about who the state reps are. Is that Representative
Winkler and Simon?
They get them here pretty good, don't they? Yeah. So I want to welcome the other folks from St. Louis Park. Please continue, Dr. Stinson.
Well, you can see there's a long list of uncertainties in here, and we have substantial concerns about all of them. Some of them have upside potential. Some of them have downside potential. The capital gains estimate that we have made has an upside as well as a downside. The Standard & Poor's 500 forecast in the baseline calls for 12% growth. That wouldn't be extraordinary stock market growth to see. The optimistic scenario has an 18% growth rate. The pessimistic scenario has a 1% growth rate. So there's both up and downside there. One of the things that we're concerned about is the 2010 final payments and refunds that we'll know sometime in the middle of May. One of our concerns is that while we have made use of the existing Department of Revenue reciprocity estimates and have an estimate as to how much money is going to come from the change in the reciprocity rules, that data is old data, and we could be wrong. We could be both either overly optimistic about how much money we're going to get from it or unduly pessimistic from that, and so that's a special factor that's going on there as well. The sales tax has underperformed in recent months. Some of that may be due to weather. Hopefully it's due to weather problems, but that could be some upside for us as well. The bottom line is that there's some reason for optimism looking on out to the future about state revenues, but there's also good reason to remain very cautious about state revenues and the state revenue outlook. With that, let me turn it over to Budget Director Kelly to talk about the spending estimates.
Thank you, Dr. Stinson. Please state your name for the record and who
Margaret
you represent.
Kelly, Assistant Commissioner, State Budget Director for Minnesota Management and Budget.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. This forecast is really a story about revenues. The expenditure changes are relatively minor. We have changes in fiscal year 2011 that are impacting the bottom line for 2011, primarily in Health and Human Services. Those are relating to the early expansion of the Medicaid program. The November forecast assumed, along with the end of session forecast, that program would be implemented beginning in January of this year. The governor's executive order implements that program effective yesterday. And so we have shifted the cost of that program by a couple of months, and there's some one-time expenditure reductions in the general fund because of that in fiscal year 11. There's a corresponding increase in the healthcare access fund because of that as well. There's also an error on the part of the federal government in the federal financial participation rate for Medicaid, which generated additional revenue in the general fund one time again in fiscal year 11. Bottom line, about $167 million additional funds in fiscal year 11. Fiscal year 12, there's really no change in expenditures, just a $9 million change on the bottom line, driven in part by lower than forecasted enrollment growth in K-12. The November forecast was an estimate of enrollment change, and in the February forecast we have actual enrollment count, and there's a 0.04% decline in what we were forecasting in November. And enrollment is still growing, but just not as quickly as we had accounted for in November. A small increase in expenditures in the debt service area, and that relates to interest rates, that folks who buy our bonds prefer a higher interest rate on the bonds, and if the interest rate is low, they advance us payments in the form of premiums. With interest rates going up, that advance payment will not be coming in, and so we're showing a little higher expenditure in that area. There is language in the governor's bill or proposal in the governor's budget that would change where we deposit those funds to eliminate some of those fluctuations in the forecast. So a very small change in expenditure. The next slide in your packet tries to make an apples-to-apples comparison of expenditure growth between fiscal years 2011, 10 and 11, and fiscal years 12 and 13. If you just do a dollar-to-dollar comparison, $34 billion to $39 billion, it's about a 29% growth in expenditures. But there were expenditures assumed in last biennium that were paid in other ways that are now being borne by the general fund in fiscal years 12 and 13. And so the federal stimulus last biennium was $2.3 billion of expenditures that were happening but not general fund expenditures. So we had other revenue sources to pay for those expenditures. Still doing the expenditures this biennium, just like last biennium, but they're general fund costs in our current law forecast. The K-12 shift savings by making changes in how we dole out those payments. We had some one-time savings, but we assume the same level of expenditure last biennium as this biennium in this forecast. Now the full cost of those payments are reflected in the forecast. So an apples-to-apples comparison is just a 9.6% expenditure growth from one biennium to the next.
So, Mr. Chair,
Commissioner,
to conclude, this last slide gives you a look at the long-term outlook for the state budget. We've had a lot of discussions here and in other committees about, you know, what is really underlying the budget issues for the state. As Assistant Commissioner Kelly just pointed out, there's a lot of one-time factors that make comparisons biennium to biennium difficult, and I think there's useful conversations about that, but in the end, any review of our long-term financials suggests that we've got a significant and persistent budget gap that, as you've seen in this chart, from fiscal years 12 all the way out to fiscal years 15, we have a mismatch between the anticipated revenues and the anticipated expenditures. In fiscal 12, that mismatch is particularly pronounced in the forecast because we are including the assumption of a repayment of $1.4 billion in school payment shifts. If you take that into account and you sort of net that out, you'll see pretty much a $2 billion gap on an annual basis between what we expect to take in and what we expect to spend based on current law. That is really the framework for the budget discussions of this year. We've got a current biennium issue, but it is a permanent one that we'll need to address one way or another. As everyone's leaving, I'll just also point out that
they weren't happy with that, Commissioner.
I know.
They were.
It's persistent, and in a couple of years, it's a long-term problem, and so they'll leave, and then we'll come back in a couple of years, and hopefully we'll have fixed it. Because the inflation is also on this chart, just so you know, for the expenditures don't have a factor of inflation on there for law, but it certainly does add some additional spending pressure that are not reflected in our forecast figures. So that concludes our presentation. It is certainly a good news that we're making progress economically, but there's still a very large budget challenge ahead, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Well, Commissioner, whoever would have thought that a $5 billion shortfall was actually good news?
Exactly.
But that's where we're at, so that's what we work with. Okay, questions for either the State Budget Director, the State Economist, or the Commissioner of MMB? I have on my list Loeffler and Kiffmeyer. Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all for your hard work. Dr. Stinson, since capital gains is such a big part of the shift that you went through, I'm wondering how much of it is investment portfolios and stocks and you know, other kind of paper transactions versus how much is real property sales. And I'm particularly interested in the commercial industrial property sales because there's such high vacancy rates because so many businesses have gone out of business. Vacancy rates are high no matter what type of business property you're looking at. That in my community, and I suspect in many other communities that have business properties in their property tax base, they're seeing a major shift onto residential of the property tax burden. And so is this primarily driven by those investment portfolios that are non-real property, or are they? Do you expect to see a lot of a sell-off of commercial industrial properties just because of the continuing recession and the change in the federal tax law?
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, I wish I knew. And here's the problem. We don't, for Minnesota, we don't see a classification of capital gains by financial assets and real assets. Now, some states, as part of their sample, do that, and nationally there have been some studies that have done it. In normal years, it's like 35% property and 65% financial assets. But what we've been through aren't normal years, and the likelihood that somebody would be purchasing a business, or that the business or the building that you had would have held up in, as well in price as it had in the past, certainly has been less since 2007. So while we try to take into account the potential decline in business property and in the value of business property and realizations of business property, it's a pretty crude attempt on our part to do it. I think you're right that there's going to be lower values and lower gains in commercial property. The question is whether commercial property is even turned over or not. And so it's not just the decline in the price of commercial property, but it's the decline in the total sales volume of commercial property that we're concerned with as well. Again, we try to take it into account. We're very conscious of the fact that in economic downturns, sales of businesses and commercial property pretty well dry up. But how fast do they come back? That's the question. So there's potential upside as well as a potential downside to that.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you.
When, Dr. Stinson, wouldn't it make some sense so that not all of that, but most all of that is from paper, moving financial instruments? Because as Congress kept putting this off, many of us were advising, you know, we don't know if, you know, which tax cuts go away, you could be at a higher rate, so a lot of people sold. And I don't think you could turn around a business or selling a farm or a commercial building that quickly. So I would have to believe that a lot of that is financial instrument sales.
Mr. Chairman, you're talking about a lot of the potential gain that we would see would be from financial instrument sales.
Well, from what was sold, Dr. Stinson, from what was sold in December is going to bring a lot of that money in, I would think.
Mr. Chairman, my impression is, and this is only my impression because we had more in the way of estimated tax payments than we expected in the fourth quarter for December, January. My intuition is that people largely waited for the tax change to take effect. I mean, you could literally wait up until the last day of December to make your decision, and if you liked your position and you were going to do constructive realization where you sold the stock and then bought it back a microsecond later at the same price, you could do that at any time and it wouldn't make any difference. Just an anecdote here. I talked to a broker about capital gains, find out what his clients are doing and what he's hearing from financial advisors and things like that. And I called him up in November and he said, "Tom, before you ask me, yes, I'm hearing talk about constructive realization. I'm hearing talk from financial advisors in particular. And in fact, our company has made a new fee for constructive realizations, $25, no matter what the value of the transaction, $25 in and $25 out. So if you wanted to realize $1 million, the fee is $25. So the brokerages were certainly prepared for that, but they didn't see it.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Stinson, good to see you. And even having heard this last night of Ways and Means, going through it again, and you live it, but it's very instructive. I just wanted to make a quick comment about the commercial tax situation. What I'm hearing from the small business people, which I think is an extra situation, is, you know, the losses of the properties, but the taxes and stuff. But when some folks have gone to take a look at buying some of those buildings and they do their cash flow analysis, it's one thing to take the risk of the leases. You know, they're leasing right now, and they're thinking of purchasing a building, so they're trying to make that whole thing cash flow. They said they can do okay, but when they factor in the exorbitant shifting of taxes that has been gone for a while into the commercial side, they are finding that they cannot cash flow it, but it's usually that factor. So I know you're talking about shifting to residential because they're vacant. They have nobody. They're in foreclosure or something. So just something that I've heard from folks. So I think there are those vacant buildings may be there a while until some of those issues. But question I have for you, Dr. Stinson, is on the capital gains also. I'm looking at this chart here on page 3, and I'm seeing there, you know, fairly strong cyclical activity. But do we also have the capital gains rates for those years as well? Because I was trying to look at a possible correlation for the volatility. And is there any correlation between the capital gains rate that goes along with that bar graph?
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiffmeyer. Mr. Michael may know better than I, may remember better than I, but I don't think that in the period 1996 to 2009 that there was a change in the capital gains rate. Is that right? Or was there one change from 20 to 15% in 2001?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my recollection was that the 20% rate came in 1997. And then that the second round of the Bush tax cuts, when they instituted the preferred rate for stock dividends, they also, at 15%, they also lowered the capital gain rate to 15%, and that, I believe, was in 03. So I think 97 and 03 were the times that the capital gain rates changed.
Dr. Stinson? Mm-hmm. Or Representative Kiffmeyer?
Right. Thank you. That just kind of that factual information is very helpful, because I think the question is the volatility just a result of tax policy changing, and so you have some volatility, which we actually in tax policy, giving consistency to our tax policy, I think helps to reduce some of that volatility. But also, but I needed that factual information to kind of have a general sense. And the other thing is that noting that the dips in some of these things are also following just the general economic downturns, not just tax policy. So I know that's a very difficult thing to do that, but that's my question was about the volatility. My other one was, and that information is helpful, on page 4, another slide where you have the capital gains account for 39% of the total revenue change. I'm assuming that is the change from the November forecast. Is that correct? It is. Yes. And then the other question I have.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Stinson. Would it be possible to get this same kind of graph that takes the revenue change from 10-11 to 12-13, so we don't just see it from, you know, so we see a little bit bigger picture of, is it possible to do that same slide from
Dr.
that
Stinson?
Reference point?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm not sure it's possible to do almost anything that you'd like, but I'm not sure what your request is for.
Representative Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Stinson. I'll just clarify. My understanding is that this current slide only reflects the change from the November forecast, only dealing with the $1.2 billion of revenue and and that change. I'm looking for the $3.2 billion change in revenue, a little bit bigger picture.
Dr. Stinson?
The 3.2, Representative Kiffmeyer,
If I just go back.
Representative Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I see what you're looking at. You're looking at.
Dr. Stinson?
Yeah, you're looking at the top slide on page 2. That's where the 3.2 comes from.
Yes.
Roughly.
Representative Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, that would be correct, Dr. Stinson. So it would be that number, but doing that graph on page 5.
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiffmeyer, that's certainly something that we can do.
Okay, thank you very much.
Representative Kiffmeyer?
That takes care of it, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Runbeck and then Paymar. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Stimson. I'm looking at a report that talks about, this is the Minnesota Financial Report, so it's talking about productivity and employment growth in the private sector. And productivity, is a big factor in the economic growth. And I know you don't focus on the spending side, but can you comment on what have we seen in terms of increased productivity in state government over the last couple of decades? Because there's been, of course, tremendous improvement in productivity in the private sector. And are we seeing anything like that, or how can we hope to have productivity in the public sector?
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Runbeck, you're certainly right that productivity is an important consideration for the public sector as well. And it's hard to measure productivity. There are really three parts to productivity. What people think of when they hear productivity is bigger, faster, flashier, fancier, new machines, doing things with fewer workers. And that's part of what productivity is, and we've seen some productivity growth along that line in the state. Think about the automation, the web access to getting your license tabs, for example. That's something that's both reduced costs of providing the service and also reduced cost for the individuals who are getting their license tabs, because they don't have to go down to the license bureau and stand in line. They can do it on the web now. So there have been some examples like that, and certainly we have the ability to process more data more rapidly because of improvements in systems over the last 20 or 30 years. If you think about what was done by hand compared to what's done electronically compared in the 1980s versus compared to today, there certainly have been improvements. There are two other pieces, though, of productivity that are often, or contributors to productivity that are often neglected and people don't think of. And one of them is making things better. And what that means is higher quality. That's part of productivity. And if you think about reducing recidivism rates, for example, compared to what they would have been, to the extent that we can do that, that is an important contribution to reducing the total cost of output. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that the cost of the output in the short term is reduced. What it means is that the longer term impacts are reduced. And there's been that kind of, there's some of that's gone on, I'm sure. The problem is it's very difficult to measure and requires special studies and things like that. And then the third piece of the productivity puzzle is making new things, making better things. Some of it's, sometimes we need to come up with new innovations or do new things to come up to solve problems that didn't exist or that we didn't recognize in the past. So there's been some productivity in that area as well. And you think about the environmental area, for example, if you're looking back 20 or 30 years, there have been productivity improvements in there as well. But your basic, the thrust of your basic question is right. Productivity is extremely important for state government. It's not just important for private industry, and we need to be very focused on what will provide us with productivity increases. But it's not just automating all systems or anything like that. We need to be thinking about making things better, cutting recidivism rates, improving high school graduation rates, things like that, things that have longer-term impacts as well.
Representative
Mr. Chair and Dr. Stinson, and I appreciate that understanding. At the same time, regarding the technological changes that have been made that should allow us to be doing more with less, do you think we've seen the commensurate reductions in employment within state government that we should be seeing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Runbeck, one of the problems with service industries, and it's not just state government, but it's also service industries in the private sector is that they don't respond in terms of labor usage in the same way that the manufacturing sector does. And one of the things, there's a famous example by an economist named William Baumol, where he talks about the productivity of a string quartet. And what he notes is that with a string quartet, you still have to have four people, no matter what's going on. And playing the piece twice as fast isn't necessarily an improvement in output. And so there are some of these things that just has to go on in there. It's important to take all the advantages that you can of employment opportunities or reductions in employment opportunities, and I'm sure that the automation of the license tags reduced employment in there as well. But there are some things where, in order to make sure that you have the improvement in quality that is necessary, you're going to have to have less than commensurate reductions in employment.
Representative Brownback.
Thank you very much for that answer, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And just Dr. Stinson, looking on page 30 of this Minnesota Financial Report, I think it's a very interesting piece of data. I've been looking for it myself, actually, but it does show that in 2009 that Minnesota experienced a 4.8% historic reduction in income, personal income, in 2009. And I think that's, you know, something we need to kind of consider here as we are looking at the budgets.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Runbeck, that is just a staggering number, and it was shocking to us as it was going on. That's what caused the reduction in income tax receipts. If starting with World War II, we did not see, except for in one quarter, the second quarter of 2002, four quarters apart, decline in total wages in the U.S. or in Minnesota. And instead, suddenly in 2009, we saw five consecutive quarters of decline. So, I mean, that's symbolic of how difficult an economic period we've gone through and that we're just now coming out of.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Doctor and Representative.
Representative Paymar, Draskowski, Marquardt. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this goes out to Dr. Stinson, my questions, or to the Commissioner. I wasn't sure who on outlined on page 6 the slide on the federal stimulus and the K-12 shift, but I just want you to put this on the record one more time, because I think this is confusing. I had a constituent meeting in my district, and this issue came up about how much actual spending growth is occurring or being suggested for the next biennium. And just, again, on the record, because this 29% increase has been put out by some legislators, it's saying that we have this uncontrollable growth in government spending, and I've read this in the newspaper. So it's not 29%, it is 9.6%. Is that correct?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Neymar, what we try to explain here is both figures. I think both figures are accurate in saying that they're describing something. I'd say the 29% growth here, it was complete. I wouldn't use the word uncontrollable. I'd say it's completely predictable because of the state use of one-time resources in the 10 and 11 biennium. As you see here, the shift savings of $1.9 billion was used, and it wasn't a permanent reduction in the state entitlements to education systems. As a result, when we did that, we knew that the 12 and 13 biennium was going to show substantially larger expenditure anticipated. Same thing for the federal stimulus that had prohibitions against some of the reductions in that. And by using enhanced federal Medicaid dollars, using stabilization dollars, we were using other resources for state expenditure. So two questions, I think, that are wrapped up in one is how much did the state spend out of the general fund? And a second question is, what is the overall level of services and programming that is going on, and how is that changing? And it's that second question, which is growing at about 9% biennium to biennium, the overall state programmings, the services that are being delivered to Minnesota.
First on Paymark.
If I might, just so I understand, then if we subtract the K-12 shift buyback and the federal stimulus, so we have a 9.6% increase in spending growth. Is that attributed to inflation or new spending or a combination of the both? And how does that compare then to past bienniums?
Commissioner?
The growth in sort of the underlying growth in spending really does relate to inflation, also relates to just increased enrollment in programs. You see many thousands of people on our health care programs that weren't in there, those programs in 10 and 11 that are projected to be there for 12 and 13. There's obvious costs to go along with that. Same thing for some growth in enrollment in our schools as well. So that those are some of the factors that underlie the growth in expenditures biennium to biennium. How does it stack up? It's pretty similar. Obviously, those expenditure numbers bounce around depending on the vagaries of some one-time events, but certainly 9% is not a particularly high biennium.
Amar?
Does this compare to past bienniums?
Commissioner?
Representative, yes, certainly does.
Thank you.
Amar?
That's it, thank you.
Okay, Representative Drazkowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner and Mr. Stinson and Director Kelly. This question is for Mr. Stinson. I'm looking at the real GDP growth chart on the bottom of page 2, and I'm curious, Mr. Stinson, if we extract $4 billion from the families and job providers in Minnesota, how can we expect GDP growth to be affected?
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, GDP is $14+ trillion, and so taking $4 billion is an extremely small percentage of that activity. And so we wouldn't expect that the national economic impacts of how Minnesota solves its budget deficit problems would be on such an order of smalls that they wouldn't be noticeable.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Stinson. Unrelated question. We've had really policy in the unemployment insurance area of extending benefits to now 3 years. We're paying people for 3 years not to work. And I'm wondering, your opinion on that policy and its effect on how people make economic decisions to enter the workforce, and whether ending that policy or abbreviating that time may have a positive impact on employment growth.
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, my impression is a little different than you. You may know something that I don't know, but my understanding is that the extended unemployment benefits last for 99 weeks, not for 3 years. But that said, your point is a good point. Certainly, if you are somebody who's in their early 60s and were laid off, the prospects for obtaining a job in the future were very grim. And over that period, what you've been able to do with the extended unemployment insurance benefits is to bridge yourself to the point where you're eligible for Social Security. At some point, people are going to drop out because of reaching that 99-week limit, drop out of their eligibility for unemployment insurance benefits, so that there's then really no sense in beating your head up against the wall any longer trying to find a job, and they're going to start taking Social Security. That we expect that that is something that's going to start happening before too long, and that that may actually contribute to a faster decline in the unemployment rate than is currently projected by the economic model. So that this situation where we have a demographic cohort that is both is increasing very greatly right at retirement age, that that is going to create both a decline in unemployment, and for the people that are already employed as they retire, that's going to create growth in employment opportunities for other people without creating new jobs. The State Demographer's Office estimates that the number of people in the workforce turning age 65 in this year will increase by 30% compared to the year before. You know, that's a huge, huge change. Not all those people will retire, but over the next year or so, more of them will retire. And that's going to start opening jobs, and so that demographic shift is likely to be one of the reasons why there's upside to this forecast. That the DEED, Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, estimates that somewhere over the next 8 to 10 years, about two-thirds of the new employment opportunities are going to be replacement opportunities, not new jobs, because of the demographic shift in the people retiring.
Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Stinson. And I stand corrected. I've heard 2 years, 3 years. I don't know. It's going to be a lot of years here, but 99 weeks it is. Given that, what impact going the next step will that or could that have on GDP growth? That'd be the question.
Dr. Stinson.
It's not going to have much change in GDP growth. It's not going to have much of an impact on GDP growth. What it will have is it will have an impact on our perception of how severe the economic problems that we're in are at this point. And that then may, as you know, if you think about consumer spending, okay, consumer spending depends upon your income, it depends upon your wealth, but it also depends upon how you feel about the status of the economy, what the unemployment rate is, things like that. And if the unemployment rate is high and there's a lot of uncertainty, things seem to be getting worse, you're going to increase your savings temporarily, provide a cushion in case things are worse than you thought. By changing the unemployment rate, if we start seeing the unemployment rate improve, we're likely to see consumer confidence improve. And consumer confidence improves, and we're going to see more spending. There's more demand for goods and services, you know, and this all gets into this virtuous cycle at this point, and everything accelerates. And so by itself, it's not going to do anything, but the change in attitudes will make a difference and will improve things. It's kind of the cosmetics of it, or the impression that you have of it.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Stinson. So what I gathered from that is paying people not to work is going to help improve our economy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, no, I don't think that's what you should derive from that at all. I think that it was essential to pay people not to work at the height of the recession. We don't want to go back to the situation that we had in the Depression, where we had 25% unemployment, mostly from single earner families, and that there was no social safety net or anything like that. But your point, I think, is a valid point, and that is at some point this has to stop. The extended unemployment insurance benefits have to stop. I don't expect that we will see them extended beyond calendar year 2011, and so this all will start to phase in, and we'll be back to a situation that both you and I regard as more normal in 2012.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Stinson.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to go back to that slide that Representative Paymar was referring to in that 29.3% increase, which certainly is a very deceiving number if you're actually talking about, you know, program growth. And back in the November forecast, besides the stimulus money and the education shift and buyback, you also included $660 million of the one-time cuts that we made in 10-11, higher education, local aids, and credits. And you kind of counted that off of also the one-time. And at that time, the bottom line was the actual true forecasted program growth was 6.6%. And I'm wondering, why did you not include the $660 million of one-time funding that you, or one-time cuts that you also included in the November forecast?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt. It was our attempt to get it simpler. As you can tell, this chart, even this chart, doesn't exactly sing in terms of being clearly understandable about what the difference between these points of comparison were. There's a number of different factors. And I said, well, the biggest factors, the most material factors here are the stimulus package and the shift buyback. And by just isolating those on one chart, we were trying to get to a place where we could have a simpler and more understandable conversation.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, if I were to factor the $660 million of one-time cuts, which I think you could include, it goes down to 7.6%. And you know, it's Representative Gottwald, if I owe you $10 this year, but I can only pay you $9 because I want to try to solve my budget problem this year, that means next year I have to pay you $11. But my base funding has stayed the same, $10 a year. But yet you could argue, because now I owe you $11 next year, that I went from $9 to $11, so I've increased my spending to you by 18%. And so we know how deceiving that actually is. And, you know, it's we've got all sorts of numbers here, and we can, you know, apply these as we want. But I think, you know, really, as we get into this really important debate, that it's really important that if you want to use a 29% number, that you also give the qualifiers so that at town meetings, folks understand what we're really facing here. And in the November forecast, and I couldn't find it here real quick, but out of the 9.6 or 7.6% increase, if you include the one-time funding, which you did in the November forecast, 70% of it, of the forecasted program growth, is in health and human services. So you're not including, you're not expanding any programs. It's basically eligibility. And as, you know, Representative Drazkowski talks about paying people not to work. You know, I'm not going to get into that too much. I do know that you, I see it as helping people with a safety net as they are trying to find new work in a very difficult time. You have to go out and be trying to find jobs and so forth. And, you know, without that sort of a safety net, they'd be on other state programs, I presume, that would drive up costs elsewhere. So I disagree with your characterization of paying people not to work. I would say it's helping people through no fault of their own when they've lost a job in a tough economic time to provide some safety net while they're out looking for another job. So we can disagree on that, but I just wasn't going to let that go. So I just think it's important to know that whatever you want to use, 7% or 9%, that if we really want to talk about program growth, and I think that's what we're trying to get at, is how big is government getting, that's a little more accurate than saying we're increasing 29% in our expenditures, if we're really trying to get to the size of government growth. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Representative Godwalt, and then Kiffmeyer. Representative Godwalt.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll try not to take as much time about it. I mean, we can play these semantics out endlessly. The truth of the matter is decisions made by this legislature over the last 4 years set us up for what we face. The page you want to look at, members, is page 82 of the report, General Fund Biennial Comparison. We have an increase in resources of somewhat more than 10%. But because we took shifts and stimulus money and one-time cuts and things that we knew we were going to end up having to pay for, and this is my concern, we knew this was going to happen. We knew this years in advance. But we just kind of thought, well, you know, when the time comes, we'll raise taxes or we'll do something else to kind of keep things moving the way it has. So whether it's 6% or 9%, Representative Marquardt, it is, in fact, for us today, this year, for this biennium, this coming biennium, a 29.3% problem that we set up for ourselves. Now we can talk about core growth and state programs, and we can use that to argue that we really don't need to change anything. You know, it's really not that much. It isn't so bad. But our finance director, Mr. Stinson, when he reported out these numbers to us a few days ago, pointed out that we have a structural deficit going forward. If you look out additional bienniums, we're looking at billions in structural deficit. So it's not just the shifts and gimmicks of short term, which admittedly got us to 29.3% and have contributed mightily to the $5 billion deficit we have to solve, but it's a structural problem going forward. Revenue versus expenditures in the state of Minnesota. It is structurally out of balance and needs to be corrected. So we can try to create the impression that, gee, you know, it's really only growing 6% or so. And, you know, if you take the growth in revenues, boy, we should be able to cover that. That would basically give us a balanced budget. We might even have some reserve left over. But the reality is, because of things like a 42.3% increase in debt service for the state and almost 44% projected growth in health and human services spending, and there are others I could cite, you know, we are on an unsustainable path with a lot of these things. Now, there are other programs that are not growing so fast. But to use these numbers to suggest that things are hunky-dory and we don't need to correct what we're doing in the area of state spending, and I'm not putting words in your mouth, but that's my impression of what's being said, that this is okay. It's not really that bad. We don't have that much of a problem to solve. We have a structural deficit, and we have programs that are outstripping our ability to pay for them. We're making promises we can't keep with money we won't have. And so that's the real issue here. So the only reason I call us back to this page is 29.3% is, in fact, what we are facing as an increased commitment for expenditures and transfers for this coming biennium. And you can slice that any way you want, but that's the challenge before us because of decisions that have been made over the last 4 years, or haven't been made, really. And then you go up further, under total resources available, you have 10.2%. And that's the reality. That's the reality we face as a state. We can't just focus on the 6% growth because we've got this 29.3% that we set ourselves and the rest of Minnesota up for. And that is what has to get put against the 10.2%, and it is unsustainable. And we can't do it with current revenue, so we have to fix it on the spending side. And in a sense, that robbed us because of decisions we didn't make over the last several years. It robbed us of the opportunity to put more resources towards things that we really want to do in the state. So we need reforms. We need to change trajectories. I think we've heard testimony to that effect here today. This is not an opportunity to say it's only this much. The core growth is really only this much, so we don't have as much of a problem to deal with. It is structurally broken, and it needs to be fixed, and it falls to us to not only solve the 29.3%, but solve the structural deficit long-term.
I kind of like it. Coming to my office in Crescent, they call it the meat locker. Representative Kiffmeyer, then Hortman, I think we'll be about wrapping it up here, unless somebody else maybe could talk to them offline later here. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I really appreciate the the comments made by Representative Gutwald as to looking at the more structural approach, some of those things. I think that's very helpful. However, on the chart itself, again on page 6, I think what is not factored into some of those percentages is the fact that on the bottom bar, it's 30.2, and then that goes up to 33.5. That's a 12% increase. And that is not being used because what they're doing is taking the higher number, K-12 shift savings, and going to a lower number, actually, below the K-12 shift buyback. Not quite sure that why that was done. So I think that issue, if you add the 9.6 and if you add a little bit more for the 1.4 and you add the 12%, you know, I don't think that these charts, while they're separated and they stack up and so on, I don't think that those percentages really convey the true picture. And I think we would have to do a little more work on these things to really be anything that I would want to consider. And I know you did this, Commissioner Showalter, I know you did this as an effort to simplify. One of those cases sometimes are maybe simplifying, great effort, but I don't know that this chart, to me anyway, is having the usefulness that I think maybe you intended it to be. And so maybe you might want to reconsider working that through a little bit. But I appreciate your effort, but I just wanted to point out that distinction between the 30.2 and the 33.5. And that's it, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's too bad Representative Gottwalt left because it was his comments that prompted me to raise my hand. He used a phrase that really bothered me, and I stop anybody who uses the phrase, whether it's Representative Gottwalt or a reporter or a constituent. He said, because of decisions made by the legislature over the last 4 years, ... And I just would want to remind members that we have a governor who signs the bills, and so that the laws that are enacted and the budget that's enacted is an action taken by the legislature and the governor. And the legislature took several actions that would have reduced the structural deficit by $1 billion. And we just didn't have a partner in the governor's office in addressing the long-term structural deficit. So those would be the facts.
Thank you for the facts. Quick, we're going to adjourn here right at noon. Representative Winchester, you have a quick question?
Mr. Chair, I had heard as I was coming in and you were wondering if there were questions about this, and I do have some, but I can hold them till the next meeting if you want.
Why don't we do that? And the other thing is, I'd like to, if you could stay after class, I'd like to visit with you for a second.
Do I have to wear the dunce cap?
No, I don't have a woodshed, so we're good. With that, good government all the time. And thank you, Dr. Stinson, Commissioner, and State Budget Director. Thank you so much. Very informative. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.